seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Brown and Ferris v. Lee.
May it please the court, Mr. Roger Townsend will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners are reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, you've granted our application on several points. I'm planning to concentrate my remarks today on the malicious prosecution elements because that seems to be the area where Texas law is most confused.
When you go through the facts, Mr. Townsend, I must admit in reading your briefs of each side, it appeared there were two different cases here entirely.
Yes, Your Honor.
Could you at least each side acknowledge the factual contentions of the other and then rebut them if
yes,
you
sir.
Can? But I found it very unhelpful because it didn't even appear you were from the same state.
In rereading the briefs, I reached the same conclusion. I think there are four pieces of evidence that are absolutely critical, and I would urge the court when it has the opportunity just to read them because they are short. And those are the various statements. Plaintiff's Exhibits 10 and 20, which are Mr. Mazaris' statements, and Defendant's Exhibits 4 and 7, which are the statements given by Commissioners Lackner and McNair to the District Attorney. They lay out in very good detail, I think, the material facts that the court will need to concentrate on. What they say, in essence, is that BFI was trying to get this garbage contract that was being negotiated among various companies. Mr. Leek was in charge of the negotiations as city manager. At various times, proposals would be made by the different companies, and Mr. Leek's job was to try to negotiate the best deal he could get from each of the companies. That led Commissioners Lackner and McNair to conclude that the proposals were confidential because, in their words, you don't let the other guy know what this person has bid, otherwise they'll just come in a dollar lower and you won't necessarily get the best deal that you could get if they were bidding in ignorance. In any event, GMS appeared on the scene, a company that was not yet formed, backed by a man from Laredo, and it eventually got the contract, even though they did not technically comply with the requirements that the city had set forth. They altered them, the city voted to substitute those. What Mr. Mazaris did was eventually hear about the Texas Ranger investigation that was ongoing into city corruption. Through BFI's security officer, he checked into that, asked, are they looking into the garbage contract? The security man said, I don't know. He called someone who knew at the Rangers. They said, we haven't heard about that. Should we look into it? And he said, well, Mazaris told me some unusual things happened. So they said, we'd like to talk to Mazaris. Mazaris said, I don't have time to come see you, but if you'll come see me, I'll talk to you. And that's where the ball got rolling. The statements by Mazaris, and this is the interesting thing when you read them, they concentrate on just the peculiarities in the process, the fact that originally the commission voted to give BFI the contract, then later changed its mind at the last minute, then the negotiations dragged out, different terms are being proposed and changed, those sorts of things. And the major thrust of the statement by Mazaris is about a campaign contribution that was solicited by the mayor on behalf of Commissioner Jesse Sloss. Sloss had initially voted against giving BFI the contract. The mayor told Mazaris, Mr. Sloss needs a campaign contribution of $1,000 in cash. Mazaris responded that we don't give anybody more than $500 and we won't give cash, we'll give a check. They took it at the mayor's advice to Mr. Sloss's house. Mr. Sloss comes to the door and says, I'm not touching this. What are you trying to do? Get me indicted. They then go back to the mayor and say, you know, what happened? You told us to take him a contribution. We did. He refused it. And the mayor sort of says, well, you know, I told you it needed to be in cash, that sort of thing. These things are in Mazaris' statement. Now, in addition, Mazaris at one point mentioned Mr. Zavaleta, who's the companion case that's not before the court, that Zavaleta had approached him in the hallway and said, if you're going to do business with Brownsville city government, you need to have a bank account in Brownsville. Here's Mr. Silva, my cousin. He runs the local bank. Why don't you talk to him about doing business? Mazaros put that in his statement. The prosecutors decided that that was a crime. They indicted Zava Levitt. That was the other lawsuit that we then won on appeal. Also in the first statement at the bottom is a very, in my opinion, innocuous statement by Mazaros that says, I would like to add that the contract proposals we were making were not to be used as public records. They were between us and the city. I didn't want anybody else seeing them. Nowhere did he say somebody's handing them out. Nowhere did he say Ken Leek is handing them out. There is then a subsequent statement given by Mazaros the day, I believe the day that the grand jury was convened. Mazaros showed up at the hearing but did not testify, but they took a statement from him out in the hallway. And that statement, Mazaros goes into more detail about the dissemination of the garbage, of the proposals. But again, he does not accuse Leek of a crime. He does not accuse Leek of handing out the proposals. He simply reiterates that I thought these were our private, confidential matters. I told Ken Leek that they were not to be used by other people or that I thought they were private, but that Leek told me he had checked with a city attorney who told Leek that they were public records. And then Mazar says in his statement, since the city attorney had told him that, there was nothing I could do. I again would like to add that I never authorized anybody to share our contracts with anybody else.
Court of Appeals says that it's unclear what Mr. Leek was indicted for. Is that revealed in the record?
I don't think it's unclear. He was indicted for official misconduct on April 7, 1986 for handing out confidential information that would give someone a competitive advantage. That's the exact words of the indictment.
The Court of Appeals mentions the Open Records Act. There's no, is there nothing in the record that would indicate the indictment related to that?
No, the indictment does not refer to that. There was some testimony when they were trying to show that these really are public records. They said, well, Mr. Leek had to hand them out. And then somebody else said, well, there's an exception if it's confidential information, competitive advantage bidding stuff you don't hand out. And in fact, Commissioner Lackner in his affidavit, Defendant's Exhibit 7, uses the word confidential 9 times in his 2-page affidavit that he considered it confidential. McNair in his affidavit goes even further. McNair says, Ken Leek told me he knew they were private. And McNair goes one step beyond that, saying, I suspected Ken Leek of passing out the information.
Is the Court of Appeals recitation of the facts accurate?
In general, it is, Your Honor. In general, if you go by the standard of review, it is an accurate statement of the facts. There's a little, shift of emphasis here and there, but in general, we are not challenging that. And the reason is that under the legal principles that we're enunciating, we don't feel like we need to challenge that. There are a couple of more interesting things on the facts, and then I'll get into the legal argument itself. At his deposition, Mr. Leek agreed that Mazaros' statements were accurate. Now, he then made 59 changes in his 90-page deposition and backed off the testimony. But at trial, we asked him, did Mazaros say to you what he said in his statement, which is, I think these are private and confidential? He said, yes, he did. He told me that. Did you tell him that the city attorney had told you no, they're public records? Yes, I told him that. And that's what his statement says. Yes, it is. The other interesting fact is that by the district attorney's admission, most of the information for the indictment, or much of it, I can't say which is most, came from McNair's affidavit, because McNair is the man who is accusing Lee of passing it out, who talks about how every time BFI would do a proposal, GMS then would suddenly change its form and it would look just like BFI's, except the rate would be slightly better, and those sorts of things. So according to the young district attorney prosecuting the case, McNair's affidavit was the critical factor in getting the prosecution. The other interesting thing is there's no testimony that Leach ever said, I mean, that Mazzaros ever said anything about April 7th, which is the very date the indictment specifies. So obviously the prosecutor had to get that information from somewhere else. Now, given that evidence, the question becomes, how did the jury find against us? And I was talking about the case with someone the other day, and they said, you know, why did the jury get so mad at BFI? And one of my responses was, well, they didn't really get that mad because under the net or the cash flow testimony, that's one of our other points of error, they thought they were only submitting a $15 fine on BFI. Because under the cash flow testimony, $1.5 million to BFI is $15 to the average worker. So we don't have a jury that's really upset with BFI. But the other reason is the way the charge was submitted, and this is also what the Court of Appeals went off on. The charge as submitted was the kind of charge you would do in a case involving the complainant accusing someone of a crime, actually going to the prosecutors and saying, I want you to arrest Leach because he committed a crime. This is not that type of case. This is a case where the person merely cooperated with the authorities by giving information, answering questions, those sorts of things. The restatement recognizes clearly that you have two distinct rules for those types of cases. The first is called an initiation case. The second is called a procurement case. With an initiation case where you actually file the criminal charges, the law requires probable cause, a reasonable belief that the person is guilty. That makes sense because you are actually saying he is guilty. But applied to our type of case, the procurement or the cooperation case, it makes no sense at all. And this was the subject of great cross-examination at trial, and it's in the appellate court's opinion. They have convicted or found Mr. Mazzaros liable because he freely admitted, I did not think Ken Leach had committed a crime. He took the stand and was asked that, and he said, no, I don't think he committed a crime. And the Court of Appeals says, okay, bang, no probable cause. By his own admission, he doesn't believe he committed a crime. Well, why should that matter? He never said he committed a crime. He never accused him of committing a crime. Never told the district attorneys he had committed a crime. He never even said the underlying facts that led the DA to conclude it was a crime. He never said, Leach is handing out our confidential information. He simply said, I've been dealing with Leach because he's handling the negotiations. That's an undisputed fact. And then separately, he said, I think our information was private. The DA, and primarily through McNair's affidavit, made the leap, the inference, that it was, in fact, Leach who was handing out the information, and that led to the lawsuit.
And when he said that, he knew that this information that he viewed as private had already been discussed in the public record, didn't he?
That's not completely accurate, Your Honor. The knowledge
seems to be the thrust of the CA opinion. All the things that he knew were public that he didn't tell them.
The knowledge factor is what's in dispute here, and let's go through that if I may. There is not a statement in Mazzaros' affidavit that these are definitely public records. It's always couched up in terms of, in my opinion, these are public, or I think they're public, or I never authorized anybody at Brownsville to make them public. That's one factor. They then, on the other side, refer to the fact that some of the form contracts are on file with other cities as public records. And that is true, but those terms are different. And the district attorney said it's not the fact it was a form contract that's public, it's the terms and rates that are confidential that were being passed around. And that's what Blackner and McNair were objecting to as well. The issue of Mazzaros' knowledge is very critical here because we would really want to hold a layperson to the standard of being second-guessed as to a mistaken belief he may have. And to show you how it played in this case, the plaintiffs put on a lawyer to give expert testimony that, in his opinion, these were public records. So we have Mr. Mazzaros, a layman, being countered by expert testimony from a lawyer that these are public records. That's why the restatement draws the bright line and just says you have to make a knowing false statement to the prosecutors to be liable in a cooperation case.
Mr. Townsend, is there any dispute that the Brownsville City Commission was already under investigation by the Texas Rangers at the time all of this occurred?
I don't believe so. It's unclear what the Rangers were investigating, but they had already been called in to investigate corruption in Brownsville City government.
Well, I'm referring to the Zavaleta case. The court makes a statement that the Brownsville City Commission at some time prior to the indictment of Mr. Zavaleta had requested the Texas Rangers and other law enforcement agencies to institute an investigation.
That is correct.
So I understand you correctly, are you saying that question number one muddled or mixed the types of cases that the restatement attempts to distinguish?
Yes. I think the problem with question one, and this is an issue for the court to try to straighten out the law, you have to recognize the two different types of cases. If this had been a case where Mazaros had actually accused him of a crime, told the prosecutor to file charges, he did this. Question number one is probably accurate. But in this type of case, we're dealing with this cooperation case, the inquiry as worded about probable cause makes no sense. Now, you could reword it. You could leave it as probable cause, but ask, did the person have a reason to believe what he was saying to the authorities is true?
Was there a finding of malice here?
There was a finding of malice.
Well, is it your contention that if you have malice and knowingly don't make a full and fair disclosure that you're not liable?
But let me explain that. There's no finding that he knowingly failed to make a full and fair disclosure. That's the issue we think should have been submitted, and that's why we're here today. But malice, all the cases hold in this state and around the country, malice does not tell you anything about whether the witness had probable cause, because you can hate someone but still have seen them commit a crime.
And as far as probable cause is concerned, you referred to BFI against Zavaleta earlier. Is that an accurate statement of the law on probable cause, case you want?
In the cooperation context, it can be, yes, sir. It's so muddied up, and let me explain this. Some of the cases talk about this knowing falsity in terms of probable cause. Others talk about it in terms of causation. If you lied to the authorities, then you have caused the prosecution. But if you're just answering questions and you haven't knowingly lied to them, then you have not caused the prosecution. Other cases talk about it in terms of full and fair disclosure. The cases are simply all over the board on that. I think the sensible rule is the very charge objection that we made that says if you're making, it's sort of like a legal fiction. You tell the jury that unless the person made a knowing false statement, they are presumed to have acted with probable cause. It doesn't seem to me to really fit with probable cause, but a lot of the cases talk about it there. The real issue in straightening out the law, I think you need to consider, is do you want to continue adopting a requirement that's not in the restatement? Some of the Texas cases already talk about knowing falsity in this, but they also talk about a withholding material information. And the real policy argument is do you want to put people to that risk of being second-guessed about their determination as to whether something is material or not? The policy arguments the other way would be that the prosecutors and police are professionals. They should know what questions to ask. It's going to deter someone from coming forward and cooperating if they're going to be second-guessed later, or as in this case, by a lawyer, about whether something they knew but didn't say, perhaps because they didn't think it was relevant, somebody else finds is material, or the simple case of eyewitness testimony, where people disagree, often quite sincerely, about what someone looked like, and then you could have testimony at trial that a reasonable person would not have made this mistake, and those sorts of issues.
Doesn't Zavaleta, the case you prevailed in, stand, among other things, for the proposition that probable cause doesn't exist when the defendant fails to disclose all the material facts?
That is correct, Your Honor, it does.
So if we applied that case here, your charge objection wouldn't have any merit.
That charge objection would not, but let me go now to my second point. There are two things going on here, and I've probably argued it in reverse order, but it's time to clarify. I win this case because they don't have a proximate causation finding on the failure to make a full and fair disclosure. So if you want to write a very narrow opinion, you can simply say, we objected to the omission of proximate cause from full and fair disclosure, and we win. If you want to go further and try to clarify the law, then all the things I've been talking about before that become relevant. Here's why proximate cause is required. In this very case, one of their contentions was that Mazzaro said the contract negotiations were unusual, period. All right, we got Leek on the stand. He admitted, yes, I agree, they were unusual. So they dropped that. They then say, okay, Mr. Mazzaro, so you have this statement, one sentence in one of your statements that says, Mr. Leek kept changing the terms of the negotiations, period. Okay? And they cross-examined Mazzaro's, Your Honor, may I continue? Cross-examining very hostily about, now you know that's not true, he's only acting at the direction of the city commissioners, blah, blah, blah. The point being that even if that were a failure to make an accurate disclosure, that he kept changing terms of negotiations, you have to show that somehow that caused the indictment. Here it did not. He wasn't indicted for changing terms of negotiations. He was indicted for handing out confidential information. That's why the proximate cause finding wins the case for us.
If question number one were otherwise not effective, why didn't that ask about causation?
Because number one only talks about cause, aid, or cooperating causing. We say the standard should always be proximate cause because cooperate, I mean, talking to the police is cooperating. But beyond that, you would have to have the knowing falsity standard or the failure to make disclosure if the court decides to stop it, which is not in number one. So number two, the full and fair, is not tied to number one. There's just no causation connected there at all.
Well, is question number one a probable cause issue or a
It was a
causation
probable
issue.
Cause, malice, and aid and cooperate, all three in one.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Neil Norquist will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Neil Norquist, and I represent the respondents, Kenneth and Nydia Leek. I'd like to first address the question of charge error, if I might, and in particular, the assertion that two essential elements of the cause of action for malicious prosecution were entirely omitted from the charge in this case, those being two of the elements that have been discussed, or alleged elements that have been discussed in the last few minutes, the first of which is the proposition that there must have been false information knowingly disseminated to the prosecuting authorities or the investigating authorities, as in this case, which brought about the prosecution. And the second being that there must be a finding of proximate causation in a malicious prosecution case. All of the courts that have had occasion to discuss the elements of a malicious prosecution after reviewing the restatement and the preceding authorities have stated that there are seven elements of a malicious prosecution, and we have cited the holdings in our brief. Those seven elements are, first, that there had been a commencement of a criminal prosecution against the plaintiff. That was undisputed in this case. Second, that has been caused by the defendant or through the defendant's aid or cooperation. Or through the defendant's aid or cooperation, of course, covers a situation such as this where we have somebody other than the public prosecutor bringing the prosecution or that we believe is responsible for it.
Mr. Norquist,
yes, sir.
Since it relates to what you just said, let me ask you, is it your contention that a question that asks whether Mr. Mazzaro's cooperated in causing a criminal prosecution to be commenced is a sufficient jury finding to uphold the malicious prosecution case?
That is the question as stated in the very words of the element, Your Honor. I would not be adverse to, in fact, I think it would be helpful for the jury to have a more complete definition of what aid or cooperation means. But if that instruction or definition is given, I think it should include all of the terms and all of the concepts found in subsection G of section 653 of the Restatement of Torts, which is the subsection that the court in Thomas v. Cisneros and all of the authority relied upon by petitioners quotes and cites from in order to bring forth the contention that a knowing falsehood is an element of a malicious prosecution case. That's not what the restatement section says, and therefore I think the jury will be helped by knowing what the restatement section actually says.
So
that's not what's at issue.
Your briefs have characterized this as a cooperation case?
Correct. It is a cooperation case.
So you would agree then that by cooperating with the authorities that a person can be held, found liable for malicious prosecution?
That is correct, Your Honor. The element of deception occurs and is relevant to several of the elements of a malicious prosecution, or the aspect of deception, but it is not necessary to the causation element of malicious prosecution, according to the restatement.
If any person may be held liable for malicious prosecution for merely cooperating with the authorities, what kind of impact is that going to have on citizen participation in law enforcement?
Were the law to be such that a citizen without more could be held liable for merely cooperating without more, then I think that would have a chilling effect, certainly, on cooperation with the authorities. But that's not the elements of the cause of action in their totality eliminate that as a problem, we believe, even using the correct and heretofore decided elements of the cause of action, because it does require there to be a lack of probable cause, which does bring in the element of deception if there has been no full and fair disclosure of the material facts. It does bring in additionally the element of malice, which in combination with the finding of no probable cause and a finding, as in this case, that there was no full and fair disclosure, bring in the other elements necessary, that the mere cooperation is not simply an innocent status of an innocent citizen who is trying to be helpful to the public prosecutor. It is much more, as it was in this case. So we would respectfully submit that in answer to, I hope, all of your questions, and certainly the first one, that it would be helpful, yes, to the jury to know what, in terms of the causation element, what all of the factors are that may be considered by the jury in determining whether third-party private person has aided or cooperated in causing a prosecution, to help bring it about, but that a knowing dissemination of a knowing falsehood is not in and of itself required with respect to that element.
Is cooperation a substitute for causation?
Well, it is one means by which a prosecution is caused. Is deemed to be caused.
Like
it's not a substitute. It is cooperation, if it goes so far as to effectively persuade the public authority under false pretenses or in any other manner persuade him in such a manner that it effectively deprives him of his discretion, or it becomes the prosecution of the private citizen rather than the public prosecutor, is causation. It is not a substitute for causation. That is causation. It brings about, that's causation in fact.
Well, the issue, question number one is in the disjunctive. It requires cause.
Correct.
Or aid or that, cooperation.
Yes.
So the jury could, in this case, could have found found for your client on the basis of aiding or cooperating or causing.
Well, again, it was submitted in the terms of the entire of the element in its entirety as that element has been worded. But again, in the instruction on the damage issue, the jury was expressly informed not to consider any element of any injury that was not a result of the conduct of the petitioner. So we feel that
that doesn't substitute cause, though, does it?
Sir?
That doesn't substitute for cause.
Your Honor, that goes, I think, to the very heart of the distinction that we are trying to draw between causation and fact or legal causation as the restatement sections on malicious prosecution and, for example, false imprisonment state the causation element to be, and the traditional concept of proximate causation, which of course does go into foreseeability and approximation, remoteness, and so on. I think that the legal cause that the restatement speaks of, both with respect to claims such as for defamation, false imprisonment, malicious prosecution, if you look in sections 670, 671, dealing with malicious prosecution, the legal cause that the restatement speaks of is, in effect, causation in fact, and there's a reason for that. In a case where you have an intentional tort which is accomplished with malice and is aimed presumably at the injury of another person, then the question of foreseeability is moot. The actor is presumed to reasonably foresee that the consequences of his conduct will be or could be the injury of the person at whom that conduct is aimed.
Why is that?
In the terms of the restatement, there are consequences which are presumed to follow from certain conduct. For example, where a malicious, under Section 671 on special damages, where a malicious prosecution is accompanied by an arrest, and also in cases of false imprisonment, the under the common law, the presumption is that injuries will follow from certain types of injury will follow from the conduct. But again, where the conduct is intentional in nature and is malicious in nature, that is presumed to be aimed at the individual, and the concept of foreseeability doesn't come about. If I could elaborate on that very briefly, Your Honor, I would cite the court first to Section 430 of the restatement. Juxtapose these two thoughts and these two sections of the restatement. Section 430, comment B, dealing with the principles of causation in negligence cases, in cases of non-intentional conduct which are not aimed at a particular individual, the restatement states as follows. If the actor's misconduct is negligent and not intentional, the actor cannot be liable to another harmed by it, no matter how directly, unless his conduct involved an unreasonable risk of harm to a class of persons. Okay. What that is saying is that where the level of the conduct, where the conduct itself is not aimed at a particular person, it is merely conduct which is careless, which is negligent, as we understand those concepts to be, then there must additionally, to make a person liable for that conduct, there must additionally be a finding that he realized, or reasonably should have realized, that the conduct could pose a harm to somebody. And of course that somebody has been subject to ongoing development. In the case of a willful and a malicious tort, which is aimed at a particular person or a particular class of people, it can be presumed that the conduct was intended to harm that person, and therefore the question of foreseeability it doesn't come into play. And again, I'll cite the court the case which is not in our brief, but since this question is before the court, it's Johnson versus Greer, which was a false imprisonment case. It's a Fifth Circuit 1973 decision, and it's found at 477 Federal 2nd, page 101. The language of page 107, if you'll indulge me just for a moment, reads as follows. The touchstone for deciding the scope of a defendant's liability in a false imprisonment action is the intent and object of the officer in detaining the plaintiff. While good intentions do not in themselves create a defense to the action, justice, fairness, and sound policy coalesce to indicate that an officer acting under color of law without malice or bad intent should be liable only for those injuries which an ordinary prudent man would reasonably foresee would result from his actions. On the other hand, officers acting with malice or bad intent ought additionally to be held responsible for those injuries which have a more attenuated causal relationship to their willful misconduct.
It looks as if the bottom line of the argument, though, is that if a law enforcement official approaches A and asks if B has committed a crime, or asks information about it, and A does not think B has committed a crime, but A tells the law enforcement officer what he knows, and A doesn't like B and doesn't mind admitting that, then if it turns out that he doesn't tell them all there was to know, or he doesn't realize that what he did tell them might look different in a different context, he could be liable for malicious prosecution.
I would disagree, Your Honor, because that does not involve the element of causation as I understand it under subsection B, which is neither the facts as you just stated of an innocent person who is approached, and who, although he has the element of, I'm sorry.
But you say that if he cooperates, that's cause and fact. And if he doesn't like, if he's malicious, that's foreseeability, and so that satisfies causation.
Not quite, Your Honor. What we really say is not simply that if he cooperates, that's cause and fact. And that's where I was addressing Judge Cornyn's question with respect to what the restatement says about causation, about aid or cooperation. And I think we've got the same problem here that we're addressing. The question is not merely whether third party aided or cooperated. If that were the case, I agree wholeheartedly with counsel. I agree with the concerns that are being expressed here. That's not what the restatement says. And of course, in this case, we do not have any assignments of error with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence regarding causation, nor did we have a request for an instruction of causation in accordance with the real language of the restatement. But if you will, the real language is neither of the two positions that are being voiced. It is neither merely aid or cooperation, nor is it, on the other hand, that there must be a knowing falsity. What the underlying, and I'll again, with the court's indulgence, I quote directly, the underlying common denominator, the underlying factor must be that the will of the of the private person is being substituted, in effect, for that of the public prosecutor. That's the underlying question, and that can occur through deception, such as with the dissemination of knowing falsehoods, or it can occur by other means. And let me read exactly what the restatement does say, and let the court judge for itself. This is not simply aid or cooperation, but it's not only knowing falsity either. If the actor's misconduct, in order to charge a private person with responsibility for the initiation of proceedings by a public official, it must appear that his desire to have the proceedings initiated, expressed by direction, request, or pressure of any kind, was the determining factor in the official's decision to commence the prosecution, or, the disjunctive or then is used, or that the information furnished by him upon which the official acted was known to be false. And I think the reason that those are placed in the disjunctive is because I think, as counsel has already elaborated, certainly in his brief, where there is knowledge of a falsity, you have not only the deception of the prosecuting authorities, you have the element of depriving those authorities of their discretion, but you have also the element of it being volitional, willful conduct. You have an intent on the part of the private party, and you have deception, which deprives the public prosecutor of his discretion in the case. Where, on the other hand, there are any number of ways in which pressure through request, through any number of means, could be exerted on the public prosecutor by the private party in such a manner as to, in effect, deprive him of discretion or bring about
How was that done here?
Your Honor, in this case, we had pleadings, again, and the sufficiency of the evidence is not an issue, only what should the jury have been allowed to look at. And we had not only pleadings but evidence of the fact that at the time First off, at the time the prosecution, excuse me, at the time the investigation was undertaken, and I think the facts are can be clarified here a little bit, it was not of the City Commission. It was of the Public Works Department on the request of the City Commission. Totally unrelated. Totally unrelated. The evidence further showed that the initiation of the contact between BFI and the investigating authorities was by BFI. This is not a case, as in your example, where the authority came to the private person and said, will you help us with this investigation? An ex-ranger in the employee of Brown & Ferris was requested expressly by Mr. Mazaros to contact the ranger captain who is in charge of the investigation, Ranger Rudy Rodriguez, and asked to initiate that contact, which he did, and he informed Ranger Rodriguez then, and for the first time injected the question of improprieties in connection with the waste disposal contract. And that was the first time it ever came into play. Then, subsequently, and I'll omit any references to the falsity of whatever representations may have been made. Then, after the investigators were invited to and did come to BFI's offices within, I think, 48 hours of that contact, BFI provided a copy of the penal code after discussing the improprieties that it felt had occurred in connection with the waste disposal contract. It then produces a copy of the penal code by which the investigators, who are not trained just as Mr. Mazaros was ostensibly not trained in these things, nevertheless had a law book there from which they sat down and determined at that point that, sure enough, it looks like what BFI was accusing these folks of, including Mr. Lee, was criminal conduct.
You began by saying that this is a cooperation case.
It is in the liberal sense of the term that it is not a direct prosecution by a public prosecutor, and anything that is brought by a prosecution that is brought about by or through the interference of a third party is called, we call that a cooperation case. The term cooperation is benign. It's fairly benign when it's used in the abstract, that's true. Cooperation sounds very, very, very laudable, but we only use the term to contradistinguish it from a case which is brought by the public prosecutor.
Would you address the testimony of Dr. Dillman relating to punitive damages?
Yes, Your Honor.
I think you indicated that the cash flow testimony was not objected to at the time of trial, but
we
said there was an objection to the his
opinion
as to what it would take to punish.
Correct, Your Honor. That's my understanding in reviewing the record, that there was no objection per se to the cash flow testimony. If the contention is that the objection to the opinion testimony was meant to encompass and include Dr. Dillman's cash flow testimony, then I don't think the objection really was well taken, because the cash flow testimony was not opinion testimony. It was testimony about data or facts. The opinion testimony had to do with the relative impact of a fine upon BFI, given BFI's net worth, cash flow, and other factors, indicia of wealth, as distinguished from the impact of a fine upon an average person.
Have we ever said that indicia of wealth is admissible in a punitive damage case?
Your Honor,
net worth?
Your Honor, I don't think the court has made any blanket suggestion of that kind. I think the court has stated that net worth in Lunsford and of course follow-up authorities, that net worth is certainly admissible. We would respectfully posit that the policy or the reason that net worth is admissible is, as in the indication of wealth, because the code reasons for the assessment of punitive damages are to punish and deter, and wealth has been considered to be relevant to both of those factors. The indications of wealth with respect to which Dr. Dillman testified were no greater, could not have created or there's no indication that there was any greater disparity created in the minds of the jurors by his analogy to a fine respect to an average person than had already been created by evidence which came in unobjected to of a net worth of, we believe, cash flow and so on. Those were indicia of wealth which created whatever impression the jury was going to have of the total ability of BFI and the total impact of upon BFI of a punitive damages award. And so any opinion testimony of Dr. Dillman was cumulative, I think at most, of other indicia of wealth that had come in, including net worth, and created no greater disparity. In other words, what he testified to as opinion testimony, I don't think prejudiced the jury by creating a greater disparity between the size of BFI and the size of the ordinary citizen in Hidalgo County or in America, for that matter, than they already had by virtue of the other testimony which was before them.
Can a party have positive cash flow and a negative net worth?
Certainly, Your Honor. But in this case, again, we had, I don't think there has been any suggestion that the evidence of cash flow was prejudicial in the sense that it created a greater disparity between the size of BFI or its ability to respond and the evidence of net worth.
So you think it's harmless?
Harmless, Your Honor. If there was error, it was harmless. Yes, Your Honor. We would, in conclusion, also respectfully request the court to affirm the Court of Appeals with respect to Mrs. Leek's claims in this case. Loss of consortium is a matter which, for example, with respect to the, it's a matter which goes to the relationship, the marital relationship, injuries to the marital relationship between the parties. There is no apparent good reason that I can fathom for drawing a distinction in a case of willful tort such as this, malicious conduct, between injuries to a marital relationship which are caused by emotional or other non-physical injuries to the person, and the injuries to the marital relationship which are caused by physical injuries to the person. We respectfully submit that.
You may finish your sentence.
We respectfully submit that with respect to the now abandoned tort of alienation of affections, for example, which went to the heart of the marital relationship, that there was no such distinction drawn because the tort was seen to go to injury to the, it was directly aimed at the injury to the marital relationship. And we would respectfully submit that that, together with the foreign jurisdiction authority, which we have cited with the court for the proposition that no such distinction should be made, are very persuasive of the proposition that no such distinction should be made in this case. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, I'd like to clear up a couple of misimpressions. One factual about this penal code incident. The testimony reflects that the investigators happened to ask BFI, do you have a copy of the penal code here in your offices? We didn't bring ours. That's when it was handed to them. The Johnson case he cited from the Fifth Circuit, he admitted it dealt with false imprisonment, which clearly would be an initiation sort of case, not the case we have here. The language he quoted from the restatement about direct pressure or request, in context, when you read that, it's clear that they are showing that that is the initiation type of case, but for the procurement case we have here, you have to have the knowing falsity. He also argued the proof of malice. Regardless of the presence of malice on question number one, there is no finding of malice in question number two about the failure to make a full and fair disclosure. Therefore, even if malice could somehow presume causation, he doesn't have a finding of malice on number two to presume causation on number two, which again is the easy way that we win the case. I'd like to address consortium just briefly in response to his comments. We have the statute of limitations point, which is our fallback on that, but on the substance itself, should you have a cause of action
for lost consortium without physical injury. One of the reasons in the Whittlesey versus Miller case that this court decided for allowing lost consortium, there was an argument made that this is going to be a double recovery to the community, the state. And the court said, no, it won't be, because you get separate property for your personal injury damages, except for lost earnings. Therefore, the wife will recover for her separate injury of consortium, husband will recover for his, it won't both go into the community estate. If you allow a cause of action for pecuniary damages such as this, you are allowing a double recovery, which you explained in Whittlesey you did not wish to do. Finally, on the net worth point and the cash flow and the expert, it's true we did not object to the cash flow coming in. Our objection is to the impact testimony and also the impact testimony as being based on cash flow. We do have that objection in the record.
What was it about it that made it non-cumulative?
That is a difficult issue, Your Honor, admittedly. It may be cumulative. My argument would be that it's in the province of the jury to decide whether it would give more weight to the expert testimony than just the naked financial information, and that given the sufficiency of the evidence rules that this court has laid down, you and the Court of Appeals have very limited power to come in and say, no, we don't think the jury was influenced by the expert testimony.
Opposing counsel suggested that it did not create any greater disparity concerning BFI than other evidence. Do you disagree with that?
I think anytime you have a live witness on the stand with charts and putting it on personal terms to what the juror's incomes would be, it is going to create an impact with the jury.
But the substance of the evidence itself did not suggest any greater disparity.
That is correct, Your Honor. And in fairness to the court, I have to tell you, in other cases I've seen, they haven't used an expert witness, but the lawyer during the final argument has made the same calculations on the blackboard. So this does happen. In closing, if I may, I'd like to just kind of throw a skunk before the court, because I know you are troubled by the net worth and punitive damage issues, not only in this case, but in others. The Lunsford case that first introduced this to Texas, as you all know, just it's technically dicta because you were ruling on the discoverability of net worth as opposed to admissibility. But certainly the court, as a reason for that, looked at admissibility. It has always struck me that there is a terrible inconsistency in the Texas law, in that you hold on the one hand that you can insure against punitive damages, but you have not addressed the issue of whether insurance can be put into evidence on the subject of how much punitive should be awarded. Certainly, if your position is that we want net worth to come in so you know how much to punish someone, then you think that the jury would be entitled to know how much of that is insured, or otherwise they cannot make a consistent evaluation of how much punishment is required. The only other consistency I see would be to hold that you cannot insure against punitive damages, and in that case the party is actually being punished to the extent the jury wants to punish them. But it is really defeating your purposes to allow evidence of net worth but not evidence of insurance, because that's giving a false view to the jury. And if you're afraid that might skew the rest of the trial, then of course there's the remedy of bifurcation, which you're also considering.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.